There are billions of robocalls made every year, but how do we protect ourselves from them? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
The other night, my phone rang, and when I flipped it over to take a look, it was me calling me.
That may sound familiar. We're being inundated by robocalls daily. Some people ignore them. Unfortunately, others fall for the scams. And the way people are getting them is happening in stranger and stranger ways. Today, we'll learn how to better protect ourselves. Plus, we'll meet former journalist Hans Knope. Decades ago, he started writing stories about a Nazi war criminal who was better known at the time as an art collector. There's a television series on his life. And singer-songwriter Elston Torres wrote a song inspired by the tragedy in Parkland. Local students played a key part. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Have you gotten a robocall lately? They're that automated call that you get on your cell phone. They're either selling you something or sometimes they're telling you that you owe money. They sound something like this.
The IRS is filing lawsuit against you. To get more information about this case file, please call immediately on our department number 202.
All right, we're going to just not bother with the rest of that. The New York Times reported there were 3.4 billion robocalls in the United States in April alone. Many Florida residents have been targeted by robocalls, and they're often scams. The Miami-based man Adrian Abramovich made 100 million spoofed robocalls and is now required to pay a $120 million fine. We'll explain what spoofed is, by the way. And Florida resident James Hunter has filed a lawsuit against the student loan company Navient after they made 2,500 automated phone calls over his loan payments. Hunter, by the way, is paralyzed from the waist down, and he got his student loans forgiven. Now, the future of robocalling is in flux. New legislation passed in Florida allows telecommunications providers to block many of these robocalls. Similar legislation was passed on the federal level. Well, joining us now in studio is Republican State Senator Denise Grimsley, representing Florida's 26th district. Senator Grimsley was behind the state bill, and I want to welcome her to the studio. Senator, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to be here.
And, of course, we've been collecting your robocall stories. You'll hear from some of them throughout this conversation. And, of course, if you have something that you want to share, you have a question about how these things work or how to protect yourself, tweet us at WLRN Sundial or post your comment or question on Facebook, again, WLRN Sundial, and we'll read some of those during today's segment. Senator Grimsley, you wrote the Florida Call Blocking Act. There was a substitution bill in its place, basically doing most of the same stuff. It was signed into law. It's going into effect July 1st. First of all, tell us what the bill is. What is the final law, and what is it going to do?
Well, essentially, and let me talk to you about how I got interested in this. First off, because this woman named Elizabeth calls me four or five times a day, and she tries to sell me a vacation package. Now, she's an automated woman calling me, but it's very annoying. And so I started looking into it to try to figure out, well, why is the do not call list working? Because I'm on the do not call list, both in the state level and on the federal level. And then I realized what was actually happening. These calls are coming from overseas. They're ignoring the do not call list. And, I mean, they're annoying, number one, but make no mistake about it. They're after your personal information, and they're after your money.
How often were you getting those calls?
Four or five times a day.
For how long?
It's been going on for months. And now in the last couple of weeks, I have not gotten any calls, amazingly. And I don't know if that's because we've gotten more publicity about the legislation or what, but I expect it to start back up, though. I don't think there'll be much of a hiatus in that. But when I started nosing around into it to try to figure it out, I realized when I'm talking to the carriers like the AT&Ts, the Verizons, the CenturyLinks of the world, that they didn't feel like they had the legal authority to preempt those calls that they know are coming from overseas. And so I set about in the fall of last year to write this piece of legislation to give them that authority. And then in November of last year, the federal government came along and passed, Federal Trade Commission, and passed a rule that also gave the same authority federally. So now we have a rule on the federal level, but we also have the state law that has passed. The governor signed it. It goes into effect July 1st, and so we have double coverage.
All right, so unlike the no-call list that exists, As a consumer and as a voter, as a resident, do I have to do anything, or is this more the impetus on the providers to protect me against them?
It's more on the carriers, but you still need to be on the do not call list. You need to go on to the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services and sign up for the call list. And then you also need to go to consumer.ftc. FTC stands for Federal Trade Commission. It's consumer.ftc.org and sign up for the federal no call list as well.
So I have to do those things before even the law goes into place, and then I'm going to have that extra layer of protection.
Correct.
Let's take a listen to a message from one of our listeners about her robocall experience. This is Nora from West Palm Beach.
The other night, my phone rang, and when I flipped it over to take a look, it was me calling me. At first, I was a little put off by it because there's my picture and my phone number calling my phone. And I told my daughter, look, I'm calling myself. She said, see what you have to say. I picked it up, and it was AT&T, allegedly saying my number had been flagged for fraud and that I would need to give them my last four digits of my social security number immediately. I laughed and hung up. I got that call two more times. And then this week, just starting on Monday, I've gotten several calls from people saying they missed a call from me. I made a choice to call AT&T and they had told me my number had been phished and was being used to mask other people's true numbers. I hope they're not trying to pull the same scam using my phone number.
So first of all, robocalls in general, they're illegal. Right?
They are illegal. And I'm laughing at this because I got the same call last week.
Oh, you did?
I did. And what you need to do when you get that is screenshot the call coming in and then go to the FTC, the consumer.ftc.org, or sorry, .gov, and file that complaint with them.
Wow. Oh, okay. So, you know, they're finding as many ways as possible. One of the things I thought was interesting that you said is that we don't know how many, but a lot of these are coming from overseas. This is one of the loopholes. This is how they find a way to get around the law, is basically they're calling from overseas.
We do. And so the carriers have lists. It's called the Do Not Originate Numbers, or it's the North American Numbering System. If the number that's being called from is not on one of those lists, then they know it's from overseas. So they have known where these calls are coming from. They just haven't had the legal authority to preempt them, and now they do.
And I should clarify, are all robocalls illegal, or is just the ones that are coming from overseas?
The ones that are not let me back up.
Yeah.
They are all illegal if you are on the do not call list.
Okay.
Unless it's certain charities are exempted and certain political calls are exempted, but otherwise, anyone trying to get your personal information, that's illegal. So now, but with addition to this bill, the calls that are coming from overseas, the carriers will have the ability to block those. And yes, they are illegal.
Does the law have the teeth? I mean, because one of the complaints I remember here is like people will say, well, wait a minute, I'm on the no call list. You said it yourself. And all of a sudden I'm getting these calls. So, I mean, do you foresee any issues where these robocallers are just going to try to find a way around this now?
Well, I think anytime you pass legislation, the bad guys always try to find with the invent of technology, a ways around it. And it's just something that we have to stay ahead of. But I'm as frustrated with it as anyone else that's listening to this program, because, I mean, like I said, they're annoying, but they're after your information.
Have you heard from a lot of your constituents about this?
Oh, yeah. Everywhere I go to speak, you know, when we go before the legislative session and after, I mean, that's the number one complaint. And I always ask them, do you think the do not call list is working? And they say, no. I mean, resoundingly, no, it's not working.
Again, I'm talking about this thing that we all know so well, because I think we've all been hit at some point, robocalls. And there are billions going out every month, not every year, every month across the United States, impacting a lot of people. Now, look, some people say they just ignore them. There's still a cost. And of course, some people fall for the scams because some of these robocalls, they're getting your information. They're stealing identities, or they're getting money from people. And we're talking about in the millions. And again, I am talking, joined here in studio now by Republican State Senator Denise Grimsley, representing Florida's 26th district. She, again, had passed she had written a bill this past session, and there was another bill that was passed into law, very similar, again, trying to protect us from these robocalls, and it goes into effect July 1st. By the way, we'll have more information on what that bill is, what that law is, on our website later today. And again, we want to hear from you. If you have had experiences, you have a question, what should you do? How to deal with this? Or you just have an experience that just is annoying or that is bothersome or even frightening, tweet us at WLRN Sundial or Facebook. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear your story. This story is from Polk County Sheriff's Office Facebook page from last year. It says, spoofing, because I mentioned that earlier, is when a scammer calls people using a phone number that is either just like yours, one of your friends, or a legitimate business. In one particular case, a victim showed the Polk County Sheriff's Office number on the caller ID, and the caller slash scammer told the victim to send a $100 gift card or the victim would be arrested. Come on, man. I mean, you know that's not how we operate, and neither does anyone else. For example, the IRS. Senator Grimsley, how many times have you heard people come to you and admit that they fell for the scam? They fell for something like that.
A few people do. It's usually senior citizens that didn't quite, you know, maybe they don't hear well and they only get part of the conversation, and so then they give out their personal information, and the sheriff's office says the same thing. That's typically, and that's what these guys are banking on. And I get the question a lot of times, well, why is it so much more prevalent now? It's more prevalent with the invention of technology, like the auto dialers are relatively new. The voice over internet protocol is still somewhat new. Those things make it a lot easier for these guys to make these phone calls.
That and also our cell phones are a little bit easier for people to reach us, not just through calls, but texts as well, than older phones, I guess.
You make a good point, because you go back to the landline phones. Usually the telemarketers were only calling at dinner time. So now it's 24 hours a day that people are calling you. And I have a phone that we use just in our campaign office that my assistant actually went and set the account up so it's under her name. I got a call the other day on that, and I answered the phone, and she asked for my assistant's husband is who she asked for. And I said, well, you've called an office. And she says, no, I'm trying to reach, and she said her name. And I said, she wanted to sell her some home insurance. I said, and she had a foreign accent. I'm like, you don't understand. Do not call this number again. And that's, so they're calling the cell phone numbers all hours of the day and night.
So we have another one. This is Therese. Therese in West Palm Beach got a strange-sounding scam on her call. She raises an interesting point about how robocalls are beyond just a nuisance for people. Here's what she said.
A few weeks ago, I got a phone call from a number I did not recognize, and when I answered, it was a recording stating that I owed the U.S. government hundreds of dollars. I hung up. A couple minutes later, the same number popped up, so I did not answer it. And a recording was left for me stating that I needed to call to make payment arrangements to satisfy the hundreds of dollars that I owe the U.S. government. Now what I do is I don't answer my phone calls if the number is not popping up in my contact list or if I don't recognize the number, which causes another problem because then I miss phone calls that I really need to answer.
Yeah, that's another problem, is that some people will say, well, I just ignore these things, except, look, I read a story out of the New York Times where a doctor was getting a bunch of these and said, well, I'm just going to ignore this, except one time the call was a real call from another doctor who said, we need your help on this patient. And so he didn't get the call and wasn't able to help the patient. And now you're telling me they're calling your office, one of your office phones.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'll tell you another story. On the way here this morning, I picked up the phone and called a doctor, actually, and an old friend of mine that I hadn't talked to in a long time, so he didn't have my number in his phone, and he picked up the phone, and he never said anything, and I knew he was on the other end, and I waited, and it was probably a good minute before he finally said something, and I responded and told him who I was, and he said, oh, I wasn't saying anything because I thought you might be a robocall. I was waiting to see. I was waiting for it to kick in because I didn't recognize the number.
I mean, I'm laughing only because it's just the absurdity of it.
Well, but I suspect he probably has had a situation where he missed a call, and so that's his method. He's just going to sit and wait and see if they start talking.
We did get one question coming in, I believe, through Twitter. I'm trying to pull it up now, but basically I think it was that somebody was asking is there a way to tell? I mean, if you're getting some of these spoofing calls, again, they're using numbers, you may know. But is there another way to tell? Is there at least an easy way to spot it so that you could ignore it?
Not to my knowledge. I don't know of a way because they come from local numbers. I did read, interestingly enough, an article this morning about an app that's been created that's, I believe it was $1.99 a month. It's called a RoboKiller. And so I'm going to download that to try. Supposedly, that is supposed to recognize some of these numbers.
RoboKiller. All right, so I haven't heard of that app. I don't know if anybody's ever tried any of these apps and knows about them, then, you know, by all means, please share. We did get a message on Facebook. Again, our Facebook, find us at WLRN Sundial. Heather Young says, despite being on the state's Do Not Call list, I get these calls daily or weekly on my home phone. The latest recordings are, one, selling me a vacation in Orlando. Two, the Microsoft IT scam. Windows is out of date on your computer, etc. If I speak to a human and request that number by that my number be deleted or challenged, then they just hang up and call back later. And she also said, too, I think you had said this, Senator, is that sometimes you get a foreign-sounding accent when you pick up. Again, coming back to the law, I just want to get your sense of what you think. What kind of dent is this law going to do in slowing these down? Billions a month.
Well, in Florida alone, it was 588,000. You said 3.4 billion. That's national. Florida alone was 588,000. We are second only to California, which is 800 and something thousand. I do think it'll have an impact if the carriers actually engage and do this, which they are supposed to do. If they don't, we're going to have to figure out what we have to do to either incentivize them to do it or to mandate them to do it.
And is it because we're also talking, I mentioned too, that on a national level, they're trying to pass legislation again to try to tighten this up. But is it, again, as a consumer, I mean, am I hoping more that the state law is going to be enough, or it really do I have to depend on the federal government to protect me?
Well, I think you get a duplication here of a federal rule and a law. So you're adequately protected as a Floridian. I feel like, based on my conversations with all of the carriers, they want to do something about this. So I think they're going to jump at the chance once actually they don't even have to wait for the law to go into effect. They can go ahead and start doing this under the federal rule. And I think some of them are doing that. And I believe in a year from now, we're going to see a reduction in some of these calls.
You know, again, we heard from a number of you about your robocall stories, and I just want to share some of these. Here's some of the more of the experiences from our listeners.
The robocallers are using my personal home phone number as their caller ID.
In most instances, they use the first six numbers of my cell phone number.
All the calls are just silent. They don't say anything, so you just hang up. And others are obvious cameras, such as the one that said my computer had been flagged by AT&T.
People who I don't know are calling me and saying they've received a call from my phone number.
I have called back to find doctors, lawyers, that they don't understand or they don't even know that somebody else is using their phone to do robocalls.
To talk to a representative and that I had to input my social security number. Of course, I hung up.
And again, that's our listeners sharing their stories with us. Again, they're just coming in droves. Everybody's experienced this, I think, at some point. I know I have as well.
Yeah, same thing. I mean, I had several people over the last month call me back and say, you just called me. And I'm like, I didn't call you. So I know they're using my number too. But it's important for the listeners to realize that you do need to file a complaint about these. I gave you the website, consumer.ftc.gov, but also on the state level, the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, the number to file a complaint is 1-800-435-7352. You can also go online and just Google, how do I file a complaint with the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, and it'll pop you right up to their webpage where you can fill out a form send it in.
We'll make sure we get that number and that website up on our social media so that, again, if you have any questions, those are the places you can go at least to start. And again, this law does take effect again July 1st in the state of Florida. But, you know, if any one thing left that you could tell, you know, your listener, Senator, is what advice would you give them?
Please file a complaint. Please do everything you can to educate your neighbor about what to do, because so many times we're all busy. We're working. We just ignore that and we move on. We have to file these complaints in order so we can have the idea of where they're coming from, how it's happening. But I do believe that we're going to see some impact from this legislation in the next 12 months. And I am looking forward to getting rid of Elizabeth calling me.
And as you said, too, is get on that no-call list.
Yes.
As well.
Yes, because
still
if you're not on the do-not-call list, anyone can call you. If you're on the do-not-call list, it is illegal for them to call you.
Again, State Senator Denise Grimsley talking about that law and protecting us from robocalls. And again, you could keep sharing your stories. Find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundown. Let us know what are your experiences or any questions you may have. Senator, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to hear from the Dutch journalist who took down a notorious Nazi war criminal. His story has been turned into a televised drama that's being screened in Boca Raton. That's next on Sundown here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, more than 40 years ago, Dutch journalist Hans Knoop exposed the wealthiest and most notorious Nazi war criminal in the history of the Netherlands. Over the course of years of reporting, Knoop uncovered the violent atrocities during the war by Peter Menten. He was living a quiet life as a wealthy art collector just outside of Amsterdam after the war. Knoop's story is the focus of a new mini-drama series out of the Netherlands titled The Menten Case. The three-part television drama from 2016 has been aired in countries all over the world and will be playing twice in Boca Raton this week as part of the Jewish Film Festival. Now, the screenings on Wednesday and Thursday will also feature a talk with journalist Hans Knoop. And we spoke with Hans yesterday. I began by asking him to take us back to 1976 when he got a call from an Israeli reporter who tipped him off of the story of Peter Menten.
I didn't jump on it immediately myself. The interview which was published with Menten was published in Holland's largest newspaper, The Telegraph, the previous Saturday. So I went to see the editor-in-chief of that newspaper. It was in the same building, it belonged to the same publishing company, and I gave him the tip that there is a nice follow-up story, because the guy who got interviewed on Saturday, in which he announced to sell a part of his tremendous art collection, was accused of being a war criminal. So I found that an obvious follow-up story. So the editor-in-chief said, okay, I will assign a reporter and let him check on it. So I knew the guy, I knew the reporter, and a couple of days later I met him at the parking lot and asked him, when is your story going to appear? He said, well, there will be no story because I don't see anything in it. So I was amazed, I was surprised. You don't see anything in it? It's a great story. There is a guy in Israel who claims to know him from pre-war Poland when both were living there. And he claims that Menten has killed his entire family. Doesn't make that a great story? And a very easy one, because you just need to interview the guy in Israel by phone. And then you go to Menten and confront him with the accusation. He didn't want to do it. So because he refused, I decided to do it myself. That's how it all started.
What was Menten's reputation in Amsterdam?
I've never heard of him before. Actually, the interview with him I didn't even read in the Telegraph because it was an interview on his art collection. I've never heard of the guy before. He was extremely wealthy. He belonged probably to the 5 or 10 most wealthy people in the Netherlands. But he was not on social pages. I mean, he didn't socialize, at least not publicly. He lived a quiet life in his palace. It was really a palace with all that art. He had a very low profile. So I never heard of him before.
Did you go to the auction?
The auction was cancelled because of all the publicity. The auction house, Sotheby's, decided to cancel it because they were afraid that people would storm the building and that riots would break out. So the auction was called off. But I went to see Menten, of course. When I decided to do the story because my colleague at the newspaper didn't do it, then, of course, I needed to see him.
When you went to meet him, did he know what you were going to go talk to him about?
No. On the phone, I told him that I also wanted to do a story on the auction. Because if I would have told him immediately on the phone that he is accused of war crimes, the chance that he would want to see me is very, very, very little. So I made a story up. I told him with great story in the Telegraph, and I also wanted to do a story in my magazine. So he was pleased with my visit until I told him what the real purpose of the visit was.
All right, first of all, how would you describe him when you first met him? What was your first impression?
Well, first of all, I was very much impressed by the ambience, how he lived and all that art. something out of this world. I've never seen such a thing before. Believe me, I'm a reporter, 55 years being an international journalist, so I've seen nice mansions. This was something extraordinary. He was at that time 76 years old. He looked much younger. Nice guy. We had coffee together. And then immediately I decided to tell him what the real purpose of my visit was. I didn't want to go on being nice to him any longer. I immediately told him why I did want to see him.
And how did you do that? What did you say to him?
I said, well, Mr. Menton, let me start telling you that your auction is not the reason why I wanted to see you. There's another reason. There is a guy in Israel, a journalist, who knows you from pre-war Poland, when both of you were living in Poland. His name is Chaviv Kanan. His Polish name was different, but he Hebraized his name. Doesn't say you anything because you know him on this different first Polish name. And he claims that you have killed his entire family during the Second World War. And he didn't respond. I didn't see any emotion, nothing whatsoever. So he said, what's the name of the guy? So I said, well, you only know him as Lieber Krumholz. That was the name he had when he was in Poland. But I've never heard of him. What's the name again? Never heard of him. I said, well, maybe I'll fresh up your memory. This guy was the nephew, it was a young boy at the time, the nephew of a certain Isaac Pistiner. Does that name ring a bell? He said, yes, I've known the Pistiner family, of course. I did business with them. He said, yes, and you ended up in a business dispute with the Pistiner family. They went to court, and you lost. You lost all the cases up to the Supreme Court in Warsaw. And during the Second World War, you came back to that place to seek revenge on them. That's the story, at least. Can you respond to it? He said, well, it's absolutely nonsense. I've never had any problem with the Pistiner family, never had a trial, never had any litigation. The guy must be mistaken. He said, you know the guy? He said, no, I don't know him. I just talked to him by phone. He said, well, I have a proposal. Do me a favor. Call him and invite him to come here. I will pay all the expenses. He may stay in the best hotel. He may travel first class. Ask him if he wants to come here so that we can clear the sky and sort out things. Because the guy must have mixed me up with somebody else. And the best thing to clear that up is to sit face to face.
And did they ever do that?
When I got back home, I took up the phone and called Tel Aviv and told him that Menton invited him to come over to the Netherlands on his expenses. And the guy said, this bastard, does he really think that I'm going to accept anything from him? I'm perfectly willing to come over to the Netherlands as a witness in a criminal trial against him. And that's what finally happened.
And what was the when was the first story that you had written about him, and what was his response to it?
When I told him that Chaviv Kanan didn't want to come, in spite of the invitation, then he said, well, that shows that the guy is mistaken, and I expect you to drop the story, because there is no story now. I said, well, of course there is a story. I will do the story, but I will give you the right to respond. I will treat you fairly, so you deny. I will put in the story that you invited him and that he doesn't want to come, at least not on your expenses. I give you a fair part of it. He said, I don't want it. It must be obvious that the guy is mistaken, that he's mixing me up with somebody else. And then, from then on, he started to change. He started to threaten me, not physically, but by all other means, whatever he had at his disposal, he used to impress me, or to scare me. I saw him on a Saturday morning. The whole weekend he kept phoning. First of all, he was very, very kind to him, invited me and my wife and our boss Ketch to come to his place and use his swimming pool. And when he saw that the software didn't work, he started to change and became more and more aggressive. Well, finally I did the story, and that was the first story. I never anticipated that it would take me 4 years of investigative journalism to get him behind bars, which I finally did.
Again, I'm talking with journalist Hans Knoop. He is the journalist who many years ago, more than 40 years ago, exposed the wealthiest and most notorious Nazi war criminal in the history of the Netherlands. And there was a mini drama series out of the Netherlands titled The Menten Case, based on this story. Now, that three-part television drama from 2016 has been aired in countries all over the world, and we'll be playing twice in Boca Raton this week as part of the Jewish Film Festival. I want to ask you about the investigation. So how did you verify these stories from Canaan? How did you verify the information?
That was, of course, the $100 million question. How could I prove that Canaan was right? I tell you something which was unbelievable. The crimes Menten committed or was accused of having committed took place in eastern Galicia, in the eastern part of Poland, which used to be Austria a long time ago, then became Polish, then became Ukrainian. But at the time when I heard about it in 76, it was Soviet territory. It was in the region of Lemberg, Lvov. The Germans called it Lemberg, the Lvov region, which was Soviet territory. No Western visitor was ever allowed there because it was also the headquarters of the Warsaw Pact. So I went to see the Russian ambassador and asked him for a visa because I wanted to go back to those places. Menten should have killed all the peasants or most of the peasants in a tiny village where Pistiner had his mansion. So not just the Pistiner family. He was accused of having killed at least 1,000 people in various small villages. So I asked for a visa, although I knew that I would never get it, of course. And to my big surprise, I got it. So I went to Russia with a photographer, and believe me or not, when we arrived in that godforsaken village where the remains of the mansion of Pistiner were still there, and the ruin, but at least the walls were still there, you don't know what happened. In my presence, Russian soldiers opened the mass graves in the yard of the house of Pistiner, with all the peasants living there, standing around the grave. They were kids at the times of the execution. They were eyewitnesses. They witnessed the execution of their relatives. They were standing there when Russians opened the graves and when Russian doctors exhumed the remains of the bodies, all in my presence. I was sitting first row. So I came back with overwhelming evidence. I interviewed at least 20, 30 people who eyewitnessed the executions in this place and also in the nearby village of Uvich. So with that evidence, there was no escape. The Dutch Justice Department had no other option but to arrest him.
Take us to the court cases between the paper and Menten. What was the primary evidence that you had for these war crimes, and what was his defense? What was he saying in his defense?
He denied everything. He had a very simple line of defense. Those witnesses were old KGB agents, trained KGB agents.
He was claiming they were KGB agents.
Yes, and he didn't deviate from that line. So I could come up even with 100 eyewitnesses who all came to Amsterdam to testify in a criminal court that they personally saw Menten ordering the execution. They were all liars. And I tell you something. My personal lawyer, who is a survivor of Auschwitz, he has the numbers of Auschwitz on his arm, he was approached by Menten initially if he wanted to take up the defense. The guy said, "Are you mad? I'm a survivor of Auschwitz. How can I take up your defense?" No way. And he offered his services to me free of charge. He said to me, if I would have taken up his defense, I would have gotten an acquittal. I said, an acquittal? How can you get an acquittal with so many witnesses? He said, listen, there are legal rules. The murders he committed are no war crimes under international law. They were personal revenge murders. He had personal reasons to seek revenge on the people he killed. He just used the war as a cover to commit his crimes. But these are no war crimes under international law. These are regular crimes, regular murders. And there is a statute of limitation.
There were so many years passed that you wouldn't have been able to get anything on him at that point.
So I was scared as dead that his own lawyer would bring that argument up. Because if he would have brought it up, it would have been a tricky case if I would have won. But fortunately, he did not. He just denied.
4 years of your life, from the very beginning of this to the end of the trial, what was that 4 years like for you?
There is a saying in Chinese, if you want to swim from one shore to the other, you need to cross a river, very wide river, and you need to swim from the one shore to the other, and you get tired in the middle, don't swim back. Once you start such a story, there is no way back.
Let me finish with this. I wanted to know your thoughts when this Dutch production company comes along and says, we want to make a TV series about your story. I mean, what did you think? And you're watching your story.
Yes, and I can tell you that it is 100% authentic, because this was one of the preconditions I made. I didn't want a dramatized, Americanized Holocaust story. It should all be according to the facts. Of course, very minor changes needed to be done, because you can't film a book one-on-one. You have to think in images. But as for the facts, it's 99. It's 100% authentic, and they did a great job. I'm extremely happy with it.
Hans Knoop, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate the time. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Again, that is Dutch journalist Hans Knoop. You will find more details about the Dutch television series, The Menten Case, and the screenings in Boca Raton by visiting our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, we hear a song inspired by the activism out of Marjory Stoneman Douglas students and the Never Again movement. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN.
Yo, this is for real. This is real life. Check it out. Big Chris
being down and all. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. That's the award-winning Cuban-American singer-songwriter Elston Torres singing his new song called Never Again. The song was written in response to the activism following the Parkland shooting, but continues to resonate after the Santa Fe shooting last week. The song comes from the Never Again movement, started by students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas, and it features singing from several children from North Miami's elementary school system and features Northwestern High School junior Yakiri rapping. Elston, Yakiri, and Miami students will perform Never Again for the first time to the public on June 2nd at the Design District for the event called Wear Orange. Joining us in studio now, Elston Torres. Elston, such a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
What was that moment when you started writing this song? What was going on? What were you watching, reading? What were you doing?
Well, you know, I sat down and wrote this song with my co-writer, Emil Demirtas. We were actually working in his studio doing something else, working on another project. And when we finished that, we were good friends, so we just started talking about it. It was a couple of weeks after Parkland, and we were just saying how devastated that we were both were about that happening again and again and again. And his daughter, who was 10 years old, is part of this project. Her school was very active about doing something, and I believe they were organizing to give the Parkland kids a statue or something like that. And then me and him said, why don't we just come up with a song, just even if it's only for us, but to help us heal, and to, you know, maybe to send a message that will penetrate some ears, you know.
What was that process like? I want to know your lyrical process as you're putting this together. What comes first? What, how, and again, where were these thoughts and ideas coming from?
It's funny because the best songs that I've written always come out really quick. And this was, in this case, this is one of those songs that I sat down with Emil. We had that conversation. I grabbed the guitar, started playing some chords, and the first phrase just came up popped up in my head, a big craze bleeding down on our school days. And Emil looked at me and said, man, that's great. You know, and then I just kind of went with the flow, and believe it or not, within 20 minutes, we had the skeleton of the song. And then Emil started working on the production of it. But it really came very quickly to us. I think, and I know it's just because it's been such an emotional roller coaster the last several years that we've been living in this country with these tragedies that keep happening over and over again, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I was wondering, you put this song together, and then here we have Santa Fe.
A couple of days ago, you know?
You know, I mean, you're putting this song together, you're working with kids, and this is this Never Again movement, and here we go again. I mean, what are you thinking at that point?
Yeah, I mean, and the funny thing is the song has a bit of an irony, especially in the chorus part where it says never again. Let's say never again until it never happens again. So us saying never again, yeah, that's all great. But we have to really work together so it never happens again, you know? And I think that's what the song is saying. It's like, you know, we got to come together and find a solution to this, you know? Whether it's left or right, doesn't really matter. I mean, I think everybody agrees that this can't keep happening in our country, you know?
You partnered up with an organization, Guns Over Guitars. It's a nonprofit that offers students from disadvantaged backgrounds mentoring. Guitars Over Guns.
Guitars Over Guns, right.
Yeah, a nonprofit that offers students from disadvantaged backgrounds mentoring through music. Was the plan to start to work with... What was that plan to start working with students? I wanted to know, when did you reach out to them, or did somebody say, this is where we should go with this? I mean...
Yeah, it kind of snowballed. What happened was, so me and Emil finished the song, and his daughter Denise, who I said was very involved in the whole movement with their elementary friends at her elementary school, we started talking, and we said, you know what, we need some kids' voices on this song, especially for the choruses, because it's going to have more of an impact for people who hear it. The section of the song, I said, I would love to have a young voice doing a rap, you know, something that's more connected to that age group, you know. And I reached out to Chad Bernstein, who's the founder of Guitars Over Guns, who's been a friend for a long time. Like we were saying before, we're all connected here in Miami one way or another, especially in the artistic world. Chad is a friend from a long time, and we've been wanting to work together on something on connected to Guitars Over Guns. And I called him and I said, man, we have this project. The song was very raw at that moment, and I sent him a rough of it. I thought it was going to sound a lot better than this. but we're looking for like a young rapper, somebody who can come up with something cool. We actually came up with our own rap. But, you know, we're middle-aged guys. You know, we're not really hip-hop artists.
So, I mean, that's at that point you meet Yakiri.
We meet Yakiri. We bring him down to the studio, to Emil's studio. We show him our rap. He raps on it. And we were like, okay, what do you have? Because we knew he had come up with something. Man, he laid that down so quick. And we were like, whoa, this is amazing. He nailed it. He got it totally correct.
Why was that part so essential to the song?
Because I think that's where the connection comes, because the song is meant for also, especially for kids to listen to, you know, especially that age bracket, the high school kids, because if anybody is making a change in that movement, it's them. I mean, we see that with the Parkland kids, how since they started that activism, people have started to notice, and people are reaching out and saying stuff on social media that they weren't saying before. You know, after all those tragedies, you know, one would happen, we would all be sad for a week or two and then continue with our lives. But with Parkland, it's been a very special case. So we wanted this song to reach out to that age bracket more than, of course, everyone, but especially that age bracket.
You've written about very intense issues, immigration, gun violence, etc. But I wonder, what's different about writing a song that has a social impact like this compared to when you're writing a song about, you know, what a lot of times people write about, love or breakups, yeah, or something like,
right,
that. I mean, because this, it's not to say, I mean, look, music has a powerful, you know, force in our lives, whatever the music may be. But this is more than just this is about a movement, and this is about reaching people on a whole nother level. But I don't know. I mean, as a songwriter, for you, what are the differences when you're writing these types of songs?
Well, I mean, for me, I mean, and I've, like you said, I've written some songs that come, that really hit my heart or my brain, that I feel like I have to express myself being a songwriter. And yeah, I mean, I think as an artist, you walk a very thin line between being an activist and being an artist. But I think we also carry some sort of responsibility as artists, because people listen to us, people who follow music, who follow songs, and they want to hear something that inspires them, not only the typical love song or the typical breakup song. And for me, I think what I want to do with my music, not only write those type of songs, because I have many records that talk about love and everything else, but I want to be able to every once in a while write a song like Never Again, because it hits close to home for me, you know, as an artist. And I've always been very sensitive, especially about young kids. I think they deserve a chance for their future, especially this country where there's so many opportunities. And to see this happen over and over again, I think that, you know, as an artist, I feel responsible to voice something that not only reflects my opinion, but what I hear is happening around the world, you know. And hopefully that's what this song and the other songs that I've written do, you know. And that's the feedback that I've gotten, so it's good.
Also, when you're done, when you have the final product finished, you know, I wonder, do you ever sit back and listen to it from a different perspective, or are you just always listening to it as a musician, maybe critiquing it? But I don't know, what do you hear when you hear this song now that it's done? What do you hear?
Yeah, now when I listen to it, I definitely listen to it with different ears, especially after Santa Fe and everything that's happened. And I honestly do get emotional about it, because I realize that what we've done here collectively, because I credit Emil, obviously, being the co-writer of the song, the producer on the track, that we've created, hopefully, a soundtrack to this movement in some shape or form, you know, whether it's at a local level or national level, whatever it is. But I think this song hopefully will just be another little notch to help, you know, people listen and people's, you know, ears to pop up and say, you know what, something needs to be done. So I do listen to it from that perspective now, you know.
Something too about this video is that the introduction of the video is really interesting. You have these clips where they talk about the anniversary of the Columbine shooting. That's almost two decades ago now. And so I wondered, you know, the role that media coverage has played in this song for you.
Right. Ironically, we were recording that video around the same time, the anniversary of that tragedy. And yes, the media so far has been very supportive about it. You know, obviously, you do get the occasional, well, you know, we can't give up our guns. It's, you know, and it's if you listen to the lyrics of the song, we're not talking about giving up guns or anything like that. We're talking about smart reform, laws that make sense for everyone, you know. We live in a free country, and where the Second Amendment is very strong and people believe in it. But the song is not about that. The song is about all of us coming together and saying, you know what, this has to stop, because it's not just about guns. It's about mental health. It's about entertainment, not glorifying violence all the time. So it's all about that.
If you can, just real briefly, tell me what's happening on June 2nd.
June 2nd is the Wear Orange event that I believe is happening nationally, and we're part of the local Miami event, and we will be there to perform the song for the first time to the public, and we're going to have, I think, most of the kids that appear in the video, and Jakiri will be there too as well, and Guitars Over Guns are going to be there as well, so...
Elston Torres, award-winning Cuban-American singer-songwriter, just released a new song called Never Again. Torres and the North Miami Students with Guitars Over Guns will perform the song for the first time to the public on June 2nd at the Design District for Wear Orange, the event he was just talking about. Again, an event to honor the victims and survivors of gun violence. Elson Torres, man, it's such a pleasure. Thank you
Likewise.
So much.
Thank you, Louis.
All right, that's the program for today. I'm Louis Hernandez. Let's end with some more from Elson Torres' music. And again, I want to thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Never, never say.
Never, never, never
say. Never, never, never say. Never,
till it never happens again.
Yeah, never, never say.
Never again.